Shalom, this is Reverend John Ferret, and I wanted to welcome you to the Gospel according to Moses, Genesis, and we're lesson 41. And just as an aside, for those of you that are listening to these podcasts, each podcast at the website, I have a picture that is related to the lesson, which is a pictorial introduction to the lesson. But also below that picture and before where you click to listen to the podcast on the website now, I normally have some commentary that is related to the lesson. And sometimes there's some really interesting links that I've given you to other resources to further your study in the specific lesson, or there could be pictures to actually take a look at that relate to the geography of the events that we're talking about. So I wanted to let you know that. That's for everything I do, every podcast that I do, even the videos that I do. Videos will have some short commentary to relate to the lesson that I'm dealing with in the video. So if you go to the website, again, it's www.lightamenorah.org. And like I said, that's all one word. And menorah is spelled M-E-N-O-R-A-H. So if you go to the website, www.lightamenorah.org, and you were looking for this lesson, lesson 41, in the Gospel according to Moses, Genesis, you'll see a picture, a really awesome picture of the Dead Sea area in a sky that's all cloudy and dark and gloomy. But underneath there is, again, commentary with regards to this lesson and a number of links and so on. That's for every lesson. So you can always come back to the website and check that out. So in this lesson 41, we're going to be talking about why do Lot's daughters believe that there are no men left on the face of the earth. This is in Genesis. We're going to be finishing Genesis 19, starting in verse 30 and going to verse 38. Their belief led them to raping their father's Lot. I mean, they got him drunk. I mean, and the Bible basically says, you could take it, and we'll be looking at that in these verses. I mean, Lot didn't even recognize what was going on. He was so blitzed. It's almost as if the girls were saying, this is the only way we can preserve our family. Now, what we're going to find is that this has got a lot more to do with the disaster that God brought upon the two evil cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's almost a conclusion that we could make. I said, well, because of that devastation, they probably thought all men on the face of the earth were gone. But there's a second major reason. And the second major reason is probably more realistic to the belief, especially of the older daughter, that there was nobody left on the face of the earth. It's got a lot to do with geography. That's why I chose the picture for this lesson. So if you went to the website, looked up this lesson, you would see the picture that's related to this. Now, another thing we're going to study in this lesson is a biblical concept called midah keneged midah, measure for measure. Some people might say it means what goes around comes around. And let me show you two verses that are related to this. I'm going to go to Exodus chapter 4, starting in verse 22. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go, so I will kill your son, your firstborn. That's the idea of measure for measure. Basically, he is saying that you're not letting my people go. You're not letting them have life. You're not letting them be free. So I'm going to take your son. He is not going to be free. he is not going to be able to go where he wants to go because I'm going to kill him. What goes around comes around. Paul talks about this in Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 8, where he states, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, thus he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life." So another way of looking at midah, keneged midah, measure for measure, is that one reaps what you sow. If you sow peace, you will reap peace. If one sows violence, you will reap violence upon yourself. And it seems to be a truth established by God amongst men. A condition like the wind, the sun, the rain, a condition that's just natural to our lives. And what's interesting is we're going to see that midah, keneged midah, measure for measure, is related to this lesson. It's related to these awful events between Lot and his daughters. How? Let's go see. And let's go see how this relates to us, even in our day right now. Come, let's go study. Let's go to Genesis 19, starting in verse 30. "And Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain." Now, I just want to stop there. This is the Dead Sea area. And I've been in the Dead Sea area at least 10, 11 times. When you're in the Dead Sea area, when you're in that deep, deep valley, you're 1,400 feet below sea level. There are high cliffs and mountains on both sides. Jerusalem is 3,200 feet above sea level. So technically speaking, you're a mile below Jerusalem. So if you're living in that valley in a cave, you can't see anything. If you're on the west side of the Sea of the Dead Sea, you can look across the Dead Sea and you can see the high hills, okay, of the modern country of Jordan. You can't see above them a little bit. You can't see Amman, but you can just, okay, that's it. Technically, you're in a bowl. As far as you're concerned, that's it. That's the limit of what you can see. I want to bring that up, only for the simple reason it's important for this story, from a geographical position. Okay, you need to understand the geography. If you've never been there, you can't appreciate what is about to happen. Verse 30 again. "And Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters went with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar. And he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, 'Our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come to us after the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed for our father.' And they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with their father. And he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose." This guy was really out of it. This guy was blitzed. He had no idea that he just was raped. Didn't even know when his daughter left. This guy was drunk. Okay? "And it came to pass on the morrow," when he had a hangover, "that the firstborn said to the younger, 'Behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine this night also. And go thou in and lie with him, that we may preserve seed for our father.' And they made their father drink that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose." Again, this guy was, I don't know how many bottles of wine they gave this guy, but this guy was like totally blitzed. "Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. And the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of Moab to this day. And the younger, she also bore a son, And she called his name Ben-Ami. He is the father of the children of Ammon to this day. Now, for us in the 21st century, in our Victorian sensibilities, this is not a nice story. Okay? Matter of fact, Dennis Prager was sharing that when they got to this story in the yeshiva, so he was in, I don't know, middle school or whatever, and they're studying the Torah. When they got to this part, the rabbi said, okay, let's go to Genesis chapter 20. They would just skip this because this is rape, this is incest, it's just awful, okay? The other thing about our 21st century sensibilities also, I find this really interesting because I was studying the word wine in there, and it's really interesting that there are certain denominations in the Christian church who say that the Torah, okay, condemns drinking wine. Okay? And I've got their statements and that type of stuff, and they go through lengthy books and so on to try to prove that you should not drink wine. Do you understand that the Jewish people absolutely believe the opposite? Rabbis say there is no restriction, none. There is no restriction in the Torah where it says thou shalt not drink wine, none. Now, the Torah would say drunkenness is not a good thing. Look what it did to Lot, okay? I find it interesting that this is a Jewish book, and in Judaism they say there's nothing wrong with drinking alcoholic wine. And that's exactly what they have on Shabbat, Friday night. It's very interesting. Dennis Prager had mentioned that what he finds is that those men, religious men that he knows, and religious women that he knows, that really observe Shabbat, to probably have their glass of wine, hardly ever drink wine at all at other times. They might have a glass or two, but others who do not practice the Shabbat and do not see that this is part of a very special ritual, very easy for them to become alcoholics. Very interesting. Jewish perspective, Christian perspective. We have these Victorian sensibilities and we try to justify. Seriously, it's amazing how we justify. Don't drink, okay? Not in Judaism, not among the Jews. They think we're silly. They said, no, they drank wine. Hello? So I find that interesting. But our other Victorian sensibilities, incest, drunkenness, rape. The girls raped their dad. Matter of fact, the Hebrew is, I laid my dad. So, I mean, you know, yeah, she's a good lay. So all of a sudden, one of the daughters said, "Dad, daddy was a good lay." I mean, that's what's going on here. I mean, it's really gross language. But consider what the girls were thinking. Now, here's the idea. What were the girls thinking? Where were they? They're in this deep, deep valley. If you've never been there, you have no comprehension of what they're dealing with. Oh, and they're a little cave on a mountain. No, they're not. There's mountains everywhere, and they go up. Imagine that, a mile up. And they're in a cave someplace down in the Dead Sea area, the Dead Sea Valley. And what did they just experience? An entire landscape totally wiped out, burned, okay? And so all of a sudden, what does the Torah say? Not your opinion, not rabbinic opinion. What does the Torah say? They're dwelling alone in a cave. Disaster and devastation is all around. Like I said, visit the Dead Sea area, or actually Google that and take a look at the Dead Sea area. You can't see anything. And then in verse 31, we read the following. In verse 31, and the firstborn said to the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come into us after the manner of all the earth. Now this is interesting because the word there is beit with an apostrophe, aretz. And so here what we've got, there's not a man, okay, in the earth, dwelling on the earth, upon the earth. You see, saying there's not a man in the earth makes no sense. That sounds like there's a guy buried 10 feet under the ground, okay? So the better translation is there's not a man who lives upon the earth who can come to us. It's upon the earth.
You live upon the earth. I wanted to note that because, again, here's that preposition, bait, and it doesn't mean in all the time. Here it's upon, okay? Now, in the Torah, so there's no man upon the earth. Now, in the JPS Torah commentary and in Gesenius, and in Dr. Creed's book, let me go into Creed's book, and here's what's going on based upon what we just read. The daughters of Allot apparently believe the destruction of the plain is to be a universal catastrophe. If you know the geography of the Dead Sea area, you can understand. You can't see anything else. They're 1,400 feet below sea level. They can't see anything except destruction. They can't, again, you have to be there to understand the geography. They have every reason to believe, from a geographical point of view, that they are the last people on earth. One consequence is that they see in their present circumstances no prospect of husbands and children. The biblical author, meaning Moses, does not explicitly condemn Lot's daughters. God does not condemn them. By the way, Adam and Eve had children, right? And they got married and had children. So if they got married and had children, they had incest, right? God didn't condemn them. You understand their motive? Okay, they don't know it. First, the daughters resort to deception to get their way. Undoubtedly, Lot would not have been conscious, would not have been a conscious party to such an act. Why did they have to get him drunk? They had to get him drunk because they know their dad wouldn't allow them to do this? Are you kidding? They had to get him drunk. He simply would not have agreed willingly. And secondly, throughout the entire passage, the girls remain nameless. And at the end, they disappear from the biblical record. Gone. So God does not condemn sexual incest at this point from their perspective, okay? It's incest, no doubt about it. But we have to understand their statement. Like Adam and Eve and their kids. But what's even more amazing? What's even more amazing is there's a very interesting rabbinic teaching tool. And the rabbis got it from the Torah. The rabbis see it everywhere. It's called Midah, Ka-Neged, Midah. Midah, Ka-Neged, Midah. Translated, measure for measure. Okay? Measure for measure. Midah, Ka-Neged, Midah. Lois Tverberg, who is a fellow scholar, writer of some fantastic books. One of them is Reading the Bible with Rabbi Jesus, that just came out. She wrote an article on Jesus' Jewish logic. Oh, was Jesus a rabbi? Was he Jewish? Yep. Did he use measure for measure all the time? So therefore, he's like a rabbi in his Jesus day. So we have to understand this concept of Midah, Ka-Neged Midah. So quoting from her article, the rabbis noticed a pattern throughout the Bible. They read that the consequences of a sin, here it is, the consequences of a sin often fit the crime, measure for measure. Several places God says so very explicitly. Okay, so the crime, consequences of sin often fit the crime. So this is Exodus 4, 22 to 23. Exodus 4, 22 to 23. Say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says. Israel is my firstborn, and I told you, let my son go, so that he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your son. Try to kill mine, I'm going to kill yours. Or that's the consequence. Here's my firstborn, so I will kill your firstborn. There's the consequence. Here's another one. Do not take advantage of a widow or an orphan. If you do, and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. My anger will be aroused, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows and your children fatherless. Okay, that's measure for measure. Now, this fits the events we're dealing with. Lot gave his daughters to be raped. Disgusting, vile, awful. And his daughters raped him. That's measure for measure. You'll find this so many different places. Midah Ka-Neged Midah. In the JPS Torah commentary, Cerner writes about this. He doesn't call it midah, keneged midah, measure for measure, but he does bring it up. The two sons are born to the two girls, okay, Moab and Ben Ami, and nothing more is heard of Lot. His story ends on an inglorious and ironic note. At the beginning of the chapter, he was willing to let the virginity of his daughters be forcibly defiled without even informing them in order to save lives. Now, this is interesting. They actually put all of this through. Listen. To let the virginity of his daughters be forcibly defiled without even informing them in order to save lives. Now, in order to save lives, in order to maintain life, his daughters have lost their virginity by forcing themselves upon him without his knowledge. I mean, it's exact. Three concepts in terms of the idea of measure. Now, one of the things that we have to be careful about in the Pirkei Avot, which is called the Wisdom of the Fathers in the Mishnah, there is that statement by Rabbi Avtalion, where he says, scholars, be cautious with your words, for you may incur the penalty of exile and be banished to a place of evil waters. The disciples who follow you there may drink and die, and consequently the name of the Lord will be desecrated. So, Lois is saying, let's be careful here, teachers, okay? Be careful how you look at, okay, this idea of midah keneged midah, measure for measure. So, going into Lois's article, here it is, reading her statements. It might be tempting then to assume that all our problems come from midah keneged midah. All of our problems. God giving us our just deserts for some sin in the past. But both the Old and New Testament loudly disagree. Job's friends applied this logic to tell him that his suffering must be the punishment for some sin. Remember that? If you ever read Job? But when God finally entered the scene, he declared that they had not spoken of him rightly. No, it wasn't that at all. The underlying message is that we shouldn't use this logic on each other and look for reasons why others suffer. Be careful. If a needy person comes to you for help, you might be tempted to ignore them because of their bad choices. You see, that needy person must have sinned, okay, to be in their circumstances. But when you do this, you invite God to ignore your problems. Measure for measure. There's the interesting thing. That's an interesting way of looking at it. You're saying measure for measure. Here's a needy person, whatever that need might be. I'm not going to even bother to help them, only for the simple reason that their need comes from some sin, some awful thing they've done in the past, where God might say, oh, really? You're not going to help them? I'm not going to help you. Now, that's no guarantee. I'm not trying to say that God is going to say that, but you could say, that's probably the stronger way of looking at it. Don't do midah keneged midah on another person because all of a sudden it might come back to haunt you. There was one rabbi in the 18th century who put it this way. When a poor man asks you for aid, do not use his faults as an excuse for not helping him. For then God will look at your offenses and he's sure to find many. Measure for measure. This is central. This concept is central to Genesis 18 and 19. We have gone through 18 and 19, and I want you to hear what we've gone through. Leviticus 19, 18, love your neighbor as yourself. Leviticus 19, 34, love the stranger as yourself. Ooh, love your neighbor as yourself, love the stranger as yourself, therefore treat your treat a stranger as your neighbor. Jesus does the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritans, okay, were hated by the Jews, and the Jews hated the Samaritans, okay, more than they hated Jesus, more than they hated the Romans. That's how awful their relationship was. And what did that Samaritan do to the Jewish man? Helped him, nursed him, actually spent his own money to take care of him. What's Jesus saying? Is he changing Leviticus 19:18? Nope. The Samaritan totally disliked the Jew. The Jew, who was on the verge of death, totally disliked and probably hated the Samaritan. Love the ones you hate as your neighbor. Love your enemies as your neighbor. Love those who disagree with you. Love those who oppose you. Jesus doesn't make it easy. I like Leviticus 19:18. Love your neighbor as yourself. See, I don't have to love you. You're not my neighbors. Okay? Rick's my neighbor. That's it. And a bunch of deer on the other side. No. Goes on. Leviticus 19:34. Love the stranger as yourself. Oh, strangers. Well, you guys aren't strangers, so I don't have to love you. But you're friends, your fellow brothers and sisters, so that's a given. But Jesus, treat your family, your neighbor, strangers, and those who oppose you, dislike you, and your enemies as yourself. Wow. That's measure for measure. You've heard it said, what's the golden rule? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's measure for measure, in a good way. For us, we live in a decadent society with evil all around, and we have people around us that we disagree with. We have people around us that we would want to avoid and just kind of, not be around. But in this culture, it's as if God is saying we've got to stay the course in our walk with Yeshua. We don't compromise our faith one iota, not one. We stand firm in Messiah Jesus. Stand firm. But we treat all people of all cultures, of all races, of all religions, of all sexual preferences, of all political persuasions, as you would want them to treat you, measure for measure. That's not easy. This really hit me, because all I teach is a bunch of you wonderful people. For the most part, we agree 99% of the time. Joe's shaking his head. But still, the concept is we love each other dearly. You've heard this. This is classic measure for measure. Classic. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done as on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. If you take that from the English to the Greek and the Hebrew, number one, and you take it to the culture of 2,000 years ago, and you say, how did they hear it? This is how they heard it. Okay? Forgive your debtor in such a way that you will be forgiven the same way by God. Oh, careful. Did you hear with that? In other words, forgive those who sin against you the same way you want to be forgiven by God. So you're going to forgive them halfway? Okay, measure for measure. God will forgive you halfway. Forgive those who sin against you so that God will forgive you in the same way. The way you forgive others, God will do the same to you. Measure for measure. So totally forgive so that you are totally forgiven. Totally forgive. So if somebody comes to you and they've done you wrong and they seek forgiveness, you want to totally forgive them. Now from an emotional point of view, from a welcoming point of view, I don't know how to deal with that. Now those girls each had a son. We finish off the chapter. Moab from her father, that's what it means, Moab. And Ben-Ami, the son of my people. They're the sons of Lot. They became enemies of Israel. So as we end this chapter off, we're reading about these two tribes, these two groups, the Moabites and the Ammonites. They were idolaters. Matter of fact, the Moabites gave us Molech and did child sacrifice. These are awful people coming from an awful pop through an awful incestuous relationship. So these are awful. Now, Tim Haig, again, has a very interesting view to conclude chapter 19. His view is this. One can hardly agree with the sages who almost universally consider the incestuous act of Lot's daughters as righteous. You can hardly agree with that, since they acted to preserve the human race and produce the people that eventually brought Ruth, a Moabitess, into the line of Messiah. What this highlights is not the righteousness of Lot's daughters. Listen to this. I love this insight. What this highlights is not the righteousness of Lot's daughters, but the sovereignty of God to overcome the sinfulness of man. Listen to this. Satan thought he could thwart God's messianic plans through the sin of Sodom and the family of Lot. But this was not to be. Out of darkness, God inevitably brings light. And so came Ruth. She's a picture for us. She becomes a God-fearer. She says that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will become her God. And for us on this day, Ruth is grafted in. She's grafted in to the covenants of Israel. And we have hope for our future in Messiah.
So we conclude lesson 41 with understanding that there are some synagogues, maybe not all, where these verses, Genesis 19, verses 30 to 38, they skip over these events of Lot and his daughters. They're too awful, they're too evil. Incest, drunkenness to excess, and rape, I mean, his daughters raped Lot. There are difficult events for sure. But it's amazing, once again, out of such depravity, out of such evil, out of such awful conditions, comes Ruth. And out of darkness comes light, out of evil and depravity comes good, and saneness and shalom. Ruth, an ancestor of the Messiah. Wow. In lesson 42, we're going to be dealing with Abraham and Sarah. Just to give you an idea, if you check Genesis 17:17, you're going to find that Abraham is 10 years older than Sarah. And the events that are about to happen in Genesis chapter 20, where Sarah and Abraham encounter the Philistine king Abimelech. Abimelech is actually how you pronounce it, but Abimelech. It is likely that Sarah is probably close to 90, because shortly thereafter these events, she gives birth to Isaac, and she gives birth to her son Isaac when she's 90. So it could very well be she's 88, 89, 90, probably 90. Now, point I want to make is Abraham and Sarah lie again, because they think Abimelech is going to take Sarah and kill the husband, kill Abraham. So if Abraham says, hey, tell Abimelech, if they take you, that I'm your brother, well, he's not going to be killed because he's not the husband. And again, if you have to go back to the first time we looked at this in previous lessons, back in Genesis chapter 12, where indeed there seems to be a view among kings, pagan kings, especially Pharaoh or Abimelech, that they had a right, because they can almost consider themselves gods on earth, to have rights to any woman that they wanted, to do anything that they want. And so indeed, even Abraham says, I don't believe there's a fear of God in this place. But it's fascinating on this. Sarah was 90 at this time. Now, the only time the Bible says that Sarah is beautiful is back in Genesis chapter 12, right before they head down to Egypt, and she was 65 at that time. 65, because Abraham was 75 when they entered the promised land. Now, this is 25 years later. Orthodox rabbis in their commentary said, well, God restored her beauty. Again, here's a question. It's 25 years later, Abimelech has Sarah. There is no mention in Genesis 20 about Sarah's beauty. That was way back 25 years prior to this. So the rabbis are using Midrash, which is their way of looking at a question that the Torah brings up that's unanswered. And so they fill it in with their own opinion. Well, very interesting to have your own opinion, your own view, but just because of what a rabbi says doesn't necessarily mean that it's true at all. So it's really fascinating to try to come to grips with this. I mean, Abimelech is the king. He could have any woman he wanted. Very interesting. The second thing, though, is like Abraham says in Genesis 20, he did all this. He lied, especially when Abimelech seems to be a kind of a good guy. It seems like he did fear God. I mean, not fear God. He probably didn't know the God of Abraham. But it seemingly he tried to live a life that we would consider trying to do the right thing. But Abraham said there was no fear of God in this place, or at least that was Abraham's view. Now, what's fascinating is, does that imply that Abraham and Sarah, they're going to lie and try to avoid these people and not have any relationship with these people? In other words, for us, is the message is stay clear of them, stay clear of non-believers? Huh. Doesn't make sense in terms of the light of Jesus's words. You remember in Matthew, where Jesus says, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. It's like Jesus is saying, no, you don't avoid even your enemy. So we'll take a look at this more in lesson 42. So I'll see you then. Shalom.